Global climate talks heat up in Warsaw today, Thursday, November 21st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A walkout in Warsaw highlights the global rift on climate change. Developing nations want compensation. Rich countries won't agree.
They say it's a red line for them. They will not be on the hook, as they say in their words, for every storm in every part of the world forever.
Also, a meteorologist's reaction to the latest climate change data.
I broke down in tears and I thought, you know, like, this is kind of like watching the end of the world, you know, front row seats.
What he did next, though, will really surprise you. And later, a look back at JFK's man in Cuba, John Donovan, and the time Fidel Castro asked him how relations might be improved.
He actually said, you know, how would we go about this? And Donovan said, you know how porcupines make love, very carefully.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. And for some people attending the current round of UN climate talks in Poland, it's an unacceptably hot world. The BBC's Matt McGraw is at the talks in Warsaw. Matt, there are some differing accounts of what happened at 4 this morning. Who walked out on the talks and why did they do it?
Yes, walkouts, walk-ins, sackings, all sorts of controversy going on here. A little bit of unclarity about whether people actually walked out in the middle of the night local time here. It was reported that some of the developing countries did. Others said that they were merely going home, catching the last bus home. But it appears there was a major dispute about an issue of substance, which is called loss and damage in these talks. And that essentially is the developing countries wanting the richer countries to compensate them, to be legally responsible for extreme weather events that they say are caused by climate change in their parts of the world. The richer countries, as you can imagine, when they hear the word legal mechanism, they start running for their lawyers. And they say it's a red line for them. They do not want to cross that line. They will not be on the hook, as they say in their words, for every storm in every part of the world forever.
So a very toxic proposal. Can anything be salvaged now from these talks in Warsaw?
We now seem that there may be some green shoots here a little bit. There is some indications from some of the ministers that were talking that there could be a deal done on this loss and damage thing, which would, in a sense, give money to developing countries now and with talks, to use the old familiar phrase, kick the can down the road in terms of the legal mechanism, give them some money now to meet the problems. That could possibly happen. The other thing that's causing a major difficulty here amongst all parties is what's called the Path to 2015. The idea is that by 2015, we have a brand shiny new global deal that everybody signs up to, all the countries, the US, China, India, and that gets us a global agreement that runs from 2020. Mm. But there's a lot of anger about the lack of ambition in this document, and that may end up being another thing that gets slightly agreed here and then gets kicked down the road to Lima next year and hopefully gets agreed in Paris in 2015. So part of the problem here is that they have a get out of jail clause, which is essentially they've got 2 more years to negotiate a deal.
I mean, we know climate change negotiations have never been easy, but why do you think they've gone so wildly off track this time?
It's hard to know, really. I mean, it is some respects, this is a process out of the 1990s, you know. In the past, we've had a view that the talks impose a deal on people and people either sign up to it or they don't, and their arms are twisted into it. But that's really not what's happening here. What's happening here is countries like the United States and others are bringing what they want to do. They're bringing those pledges to the table and they're saying that's what we can do. And then you're having to try to make a kind of a global fudge, basically, of what those commitments are. That's a big difference from the past. And that's why it's really irritating, I think, a lot of the smaller nations and bigger nations like India as well, to say, look, this isn't what we like. We don't like this. And they want to go back to a more old-fashioned type of agreement. That's not going to happen according to the richer nations, and that's what really is slowing down the whole process here and making a great deal of progress hard to see.
Matt, I noticed one thing in the press release that was sent out by the World Wildlife Fund after they walked out of these talks. Their observation of all the corporate sponsorship at these talks, corporations that are actually major polluters and greenhouse gas emitters. Is that in fact what's going on, and who are some of these sponsors?
Yeah, they've had a bee in their bonnet about the sponsorship issue here from the likes of Mittal and other major steel companies and some companies like that. I think that's part of a view that sees the COP here, the Conference of the Parties here in Poland, as a carbon cop, as many people have put it, because they feel that the Polish government has sent strong signals to the coal industry, for one, hosting a coal summit in parallel to these talks, and showing a great deal of interest in coal technologies and fossil fuels, looking at that kind of old school approach to powering their country. And so they feel that the NGOs or the green groups feel that they've been sold short on that, and that the COP in a sense has sold out to these corporate sponsors. There is some merit in that, but the overall position from the UN who run this is that, look, that's just a small element of companies who are keen on clean technology, who want to bring their message to the delegates here, and there's nothing particularly wrong with that, and there's no undue influence being sold here. And I think to overplay it would be wrong. There's certainly a presence here. The bigger issue, I think, for people here has been the fact that the Polish government is more close to the coal industry and sees coal as part of the future. And the reality is a lot of developing countries see coal as part of their future too.
Matt, we're going to leave it there. Thanks for the update.
Cheers, Marco. Thank you.
That was the BBC's Matt McGraw at the climate talks in Warsaw, Poland. Eric Holthaus is a climate scientist, writer, and meteorologist, the sort of guy you'd expect to find at a major climate conference. But he's not in Warsaw now because, well, he refuses to fly anymore. He wants to reduce his carbon footprint and to do his part to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Holthaus tweeted his decision in September after the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report. That document warned of irreversible climate changes unless global emissions are reduced soon.
I was in San Francisco and heading back from a week-long business trip and kind of, you know, standing there in the boarding zone and was on the phone with my wife, and the emotion of the moment hit me, you know, and as a human, not as a boring scientist, I broke down in tears, and I thought, you know, like, this is kind of like watching the end of the world, you know, front row seats to be a scientist and watching this data come in and say, you know, we're nowhere near where we need to be to make the cuts that we need to do on time. And I thought, you know, I just have to do it. I have to do something that I'm going to feel good about myself. You know, every climate story I write, every severe weather event that I cover, at least I'll have the knowledge, you know, that I, in one action, I cut my carbon footprint by 50% by not flying anymore. That's not enough. You know, we need to cut it down to zero, but at least that's a step that I can take in one action.
I mean, Eric, you're a journalist. You're supposed to weigh things out properly and objectively. Why did this affect you so much that you broke down in tears?
It kind of hit me as a human being in that moment to see, you know, what is the world going to be like in 50 years if we continue on this current path? And, you know, to put the numbers and the climate models into a human kind of perspective to see, like, What will we feel like when the endangered species die? Or what will we feel like when Mumbai is overwhelmed with tidal flood surges? You know, it's not something that I want to feel in the future. It's something that, you know, if we can take a little bit of that pain away by doing a little bit of action now, then that's the direction I want to head.
You actually crunched the numbers for your own household. Tell us how many people in your family and what surprised you about your family's carbon footprint.
My wife is joining me on this. It was a decision that we made together. We have the reusable plastic bags. We changed all the light bulbs in our house. We're doing all the basic stuff. But for our household, we had a footprint that was greater than the average American household footprint before this action. And afterwards, now we're below average footprint. So,
and that's because of your cancellation of flying?
Yeah. It was about 50% of our household emissions. I fly about 75,000 miles a year. I used to. You know, that's a lot.
Did your wife ever give you a hard time for that? I mean, was she doing as much flying as you? Was she ready to, like, cap and trade inside the walls
exactly.
of the house?
Exactly. No, you know, and that's the thing, too, is, you know, I'm gold medallion with Delta, and I really like their service. And
wow. You're giving up a lot.
Yeah, we had enough miles built up that we were going to take a trip to Hawaii and also to visit some friends in Denmark next year. And we have to cancel those trips, and it's not something that is great. I would have loved to take those trips, but I think that at this point, the climate is more important to me.
Eric, you've gotten a lot of flack from science and weather journalists about taking a stand, that you've compromised your objectivity. What do you say to that charge?
I think, you know, the 95% certainty that humans cause climate change is now about the same level that smoking causes cancer. So, you know, I wouldn't want to be a doctor that's still defending cigarette smoking. And I don't want to be a meteorologist or a climate scientist that's not doing everything I can to reduce my carbon footprint, knowing that this is the cause of increased extreme weather and heat waves, and people are dying, you know, this year from these events. So, and it's only forecasted to get worse. So I want to, starting immediately, do whatever I can to reduce that impact.
Eric Holthaus is a science writer at Quartz. He's not going to fly again. Thanks for telling us why, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I bet many of you are in a car right now, or soon will be. Now, I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on you about your carbon footprint. It's just that as the number of cars on the road goes up, so do problems like pollution and traffic. We see that here in the U.S., but in China, it's on a whole other level. Private car ownership there has increased with lightning speed in recent years. And in Beijing, air pollution and traffic jams have become such headaches that the city's imposing some tough new restrictions on drivers. The World's Matthew Bell has that story.
At an auto shop on the outskirts of Beijing, pretty much everyone I speak with agrees there are just too many private cars on the roads. Rush hour traffic can be a bit of a nightmare here. Beijing's polluted air is some of the worst on planet Earth, and three-quarters of the people in this city of 21 million don't even own a car, yet. 27-year-old Tang Lianghua has been fixing cars for about 8 years now, but he's still saving up to actually buy one. That should take another 3 years or so, Tang says with a chuckle, as he gets back to work on a green Mitsubishi SUV. Patience and a sense of humor are important qualities to have for Beijing drivers. One reason, the notorious lottery system for obtaining license plates. Zhang Yushang is a college grad. He applied for new plates more than a year ago, and he's still waiting.
Probably will take about another year or 2 years, because the chances of getting a plate is becoming more and more difficult. I hear that it's even more difficult now than winning a lottery.
That might be a slight exaggeration, but Zhang is right about one thing. Beijing officials are getting more and more stingy about putting new cars on the roads. This year, they handed out 240,000 new license plates. Next year, it'll be 150,000, and that number will keep going down for the next several years. Beijing already has restrictions that ban large numbers of private cars from city limits on certain days of the week. On Thursday, for example, if your car's license plate ends with a 5 or a 0, you can't drive into the city. The effort has had an impact on traffic, but the restrictions might not be slowing down the public's drive for car ownership. Liu Xinli and her husband are professionals who live in town, and they share a little silver Peugeot hatchback with both of their parents. That means one car for six people. It's not very convenient, Liu says. And besides, she wants a baby someday soon, and that will make it even harder to live without a second car. So she and her husband are thinking about entering the license plate lottery again and hoping for the best. Another thing Beijing and other Chinese cities are doing is expanding their subway systems at a breakneck pace. 40-year-old engineer Ma Wen drives an SUV 1 hour each way to and from work. He says the government should be trying to get people out of their cars and onto public transportation. But when I ask if that means him, Ma admits he's not about to leave his car at home.
Too many people in subway.
Too many people in the subway.
Yeah.
Too crowded.
Yeah.
But Beijing drivers like Mr. Ma could be in for a dose of carless reality this winter. The city has announced a new emergency plan in the event of another round of severe air pollution like the one that made headlines last year. It includes banning half of all private cars from the roads every day, even-numbered license plates one day, odd numbers the next, until the air pollution clears up. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Beijing.
Still ahead, chemical weapons destruction at sea 101 on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's been a lot of coverage this week about tomorrow's 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. Today, we want to look back, not at the event itself, but at President Kennedy and Cuba. Kennedy was against communism. He presided over the failed Bay of Pigs invasion and the Cuban Missile Crisis. But at the time of his death, Kennedy was actually trying to negotiate a reconciliation with Castro.
Kennedy emerged from the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think understanding that our policy of aggression towards Cuba could end up being very dangerous in the Cold War.
That's Peter Kornbluh. He directs the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive at George Washington University.
In the spring of 1963, the Kennedy administration really began a series of ultra-secret contacts with Cuba through a series of emissaries.
How did it all work? I know there was a central figure, James Donovan, who was sent to negotiate the release of Cuban exiles after the Bay of Pigs. How did that all start, this ball rolling?
James Donovan, a famous New York lawyer, picked by the Kennedys to represent them secretly and getting more than 1,000 of the Bay of Pigs prisoners released, really was the first emissary to gain Castro's trust. And Castro wanted to use these talks over prisoner releases to broaden the discussion into an improvement of U.S.-Cuban relations. He actually said, you know, how would we go about this? And Donovan said, you know how porcupines make love? And Castro said, no. And Donovan said, very carefully. And that is how you and the United States will enter into talks about better relations. Donovan was the first emissary, but he actually kind of turned over the baton to an amazing reporter from ABC News, ABC News' first female reporter, Lisa Howard. She was in Cuba in April of 1963 to do the first special on Cuba for ABC. She got Donovan to introduce her to Castro, and she came back and was debriefed by the CIA almost the moment she landed in Miami. And that led to a memorandum that landed on the president's desk saying that Castro wanted a rapprochement, that Lisa Howard could serve as a secret intermediary between the two countries.
The real opening, it seems, though, was coming when a senior U.S. diplomat, Bill Atwood, got involved. Tell us about him and his meetings with Cuba's U.N. ambassador.
Lisa Howard actually employed what I like to call cocktail diplomacy. She used her East 74th Street condominium as a kind of a command and control center for secret diplomacy with Cuba. And she threw a cocktail party in which she invited a lot of New York literati. And she went to the Cuban ambassador at the UN, Carlos Chuga, and said, the United States wants to talk to you. Come to my house for this cocktail party. And with Bill Atwood, she said, I'm going to throw this party. Atwood actually got clearance to go from Robert Kennedy and the White House, and it was at that meeting when the first conversation took place. And interestingly enough, Atwood said to Lechuga at that meeting, you know, it's hard to imagine that we'll get very far because the CIA controls Cuba policy and they're going to oppose this, which of course they did. But throughout the fall of 1963, there were these communications to Castro with the goal of setting up an actual secret meeting. And on November 5th, 1963, Kennedy sits down with his national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, and his secret taping system picks up their conversation.
Right. So we actually have that tape. Here's Kennedy discussing the mission with McGeorge Bundy, as he said, in a recording you got released in 2003, Peter. Let's hear it.
We'd have to have an explanation of why Atwood was there. Otherwise, we'd have to have it. The only cover plan that makes any sense to me is that this was a Cuban initiative. And we get Atwood off the payroll. Before he goes.
It's a little hard to make out, but you can just about hear Kennedy say, can we get him off the payroll? He's talking about Bill Atwood there, the U.S. diplomat. What do you believe they were talking about?
Well, of course, Kennedy is worried about this meeting leaking. And so he wants Atwood to be a private citizen before he goes to Cuba. This is the cover story that this was a private initiative of Atwood's, that he did not represent the United States of America. So he says to Bundy, basically okays the idea of a meeting, but let's get him off the payroll. Let's sanitize him before he goes.
So Castro and Kennedy were on the same page about this without knowing precisely how each other felt about resuming relations?
I think Castro understood also that the missile crisis put Kennedy in a different position and put him in a different position. His patrons, the Soviet Union, kind of sold him out, withdrawing the missiles without even talking to him. But Cuba always wanted better relations with the United States, and Castro was reaching out at that point. Kennedy, you know, kept another track of CIA covert operations against Castro going, but he began to seriously explore this sweet approach, as the declassified documents call it, in the fall of 1963. And the tempo of the contacts between Cuba and the United States picked up considerably, culminating in the day of his assassination.
Right. Remind us what happened on the day of Kennedy's assassination in Havana.
Kennedy had met with a French journalist named Jean Daniel. He had been brought in by William Atwood. And Jean Daniel talked to Kennedy, interviewed Kennedy. Kennedy said, you know, I think you should carry a message to Castro that I think relations could improve. Jean Daniel was in Cuba on November 22nd. He was having lunch with Fidel Castro, discussing this message. Castro was pretty excited about the possibility of Kennedy becoming, as he said, you know, one of the great leaders of the Western world. And an aide came in, told Castro that Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. And they listened to the radio and they heard the news that Kennedy was dead. And Fidel Castro turned to Jean Daniel and said, "There goes your mission of peace." And he blamed almost immediately the CIA for killing Kennedy. He knew something, of course, that nobody else knew at that very moment, that he and the president of the United States were moving towards an actual secret meeting in which the U.S. would send an emissary to Cuba to meet with Castro. The agenda for that meeting was actually en route to New York to the Cuban mission from Castro's office at the very moment that Kennedy was killed. And ironically, and this is the true tragedy of the among all the tragedies of Kennedy's assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald, who clearly saw himself as a revolutionary wannabe trying to help the Cuban Revolution by killing Kennedy, actually terminated one of the most significant efforts to improve relations between the United States and Cuba.
Peter Kornbluh directs a Cuba documentation project of the National Security Archive at George Washington University. He's also co-author of the forthcoming Talking with Cuba, The Hidden History of U.S.-Cuba Diplomacy. Peter, thanks very much for coming in.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Marco.
Tomorrow, we'll have more voices from around the globe recalling the JFK assassination. Tune in here and at PRI.org. Remember that crowdsourced chess match we told you about earlier this week? Norway was going to take on the world via tweets. Anyone with a Norwegian internet address could vote on Norway's moves, and anyone else could vote on the world's next move. Well, Norway's Often Posted newspaper had to pull the plug on its online chess tournament. Editor Kjetil Kolsrud says it didn't take long before both sides were plagued by deliberately bad chess moves.
After a few hours, we noticed that some very bad moves were getting a lot of votes. And after some research, we found this chat forum where people apparently had mobilized people around the world to cast votes for particular bad moves to influence the game. We just realized that we weren't going to be able to stand up against it, so we just shut the game down.
Kolsrud says he doesn't really care that some saboteurs wrecked his chess match.
Trolls, I guess. As a father of two kids, I'm always happy to see that people have a lot of spare time.
A little too much spare time, perhaps. This is The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, bicycle riders in London confront stereotypes.
I think there's a bit of a myth, actually, that sort of cyclists are quite aggressive and that they throw themselves into the path of danger for fun, and they kind of quite enjoy the aggravation of kind of getting up in the face of drivers and, you know, pointing out to them that they've been idiots.
Plus, a journey into the heart of Rob Ford Nation.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. You probably won't ever see this in the classifieds, but the demand is definitely there. Wanted, company interested in destroying Syria's chemical weapons materials. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has essentially issued that call. The OPCW is the UN-affiliated group based in the Netherlands that has the job of eliminating Syria's chemical arsenal. And right now, officials there are considering the option of destroying materials at sea. So how exactly would that be done? We asked Ralph Trapp, an independent chemical disarmament specialist in France.
You can either incinerate them, that's to say you burn them off by at very high temperatures, and then you have to deal with the off gases that clean them up. Or alternatively, you can split the molecules with chemical means. Typically, you do that by hydrolysis, that's water, with alkaline components in the water, but there are also other types of chemicals that could be used for neutralizing agents.
I mean, one of the big issues is that it doesn't really seem to be any countries out there that want these toxins destroyed on their territory. So what do you do now?
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems. And I can understand that there is hesitation. There's also public perception about the dangers involved in this. And then, of course, there is a whole regulatory background that needs to be complied with. If you want to destroy chemical weapons, you need to license facilities and processes. So, yes, there is obviously a problem at the moment finding a country that could host that destruction operation. And that's, I understand, one of the reasons why this proposal is now being assessed as to whether you can do it at sea.
And so what do you think about that?
It's obviously not a preferred option. Otherwise, one would have started with that option in the first place. And we were looking for a possibility of setting up a destruction operation, partly in Syria, partly out of Syria, but in places like nearby countries, if that's possible. Now, that obviously doesn't seem to be the case. Doing it at sea is possible in principle. We've had situations in the past where this has been done at smaller scale, much smaller scale than 1,000 tons of precursor chemicals and chemical warfare agents.
Like where? Where has it been done before?
Well, there were a couple of destruction operations on floats and boats after the Second World War in Europe. And there was a recent case where Japan has cleared up the area around Kandahar Harbor, that's a port. And they basically lifted up from the seabed old chemical weapons that were disposed of after the Second World War. And one of the options that came out of that process was, in fact, a suggestion to set up a floating facility. But again, that's small scale by comparison. It's also a slightly different technology. It's a detonation chamber that doesn't produce an awful lot of liquid waste. So it's much easier to handle.
And I suspect chemical weapons technology has changed a lot since the end of World War II. What are the consequences for marine life of destroying weapons at sea?
We're talking about the precursor chemical before sarin gas, which is a fossil organic chemical. It is toxic, and it certainly would be toxic for marine life. So, I mean, if you want to destroy that at sea, you have to make sure that you can control contamination, that you can make sure that when there's an accident, when something goes wrong, you can actually handle the situation and not end up having to spill the agent into the sea. That's something you don't want to happen. And also, you have to think about what you do with the reaction products afterwards, because some of them may be toxic.
And if you're doing this out at sea, do you need any national permission to get this done?
In the high sea, if you are in international waters, the answer is no. However, you still have to respect international law. And there is a UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which sets conditions to the activities you can conduct at sea. It sets conditions about how you have to use precautionary principles and methods to prevent the pollution of the maritime environment and things like that. So it's not a carte blanche. You have to make sure that you have control over the process and that you can, in fact, operate safely.
What are the other dangers of destroying chemical weapons at sea? I mean, is security one of them?
Security is one of them, but security probably is a concern at the moment, mostly in Syria and within Syria. It would be a concern once you start moving chemical weapons to the coast, and then, of course, during the operations at the port site when you load these weapons onto boats. Once you're on the sea, security remains a concern, but it's of a different nature. But of course, you're also in what I consider to be an unpredictable and potentially dangerous environment. You are at sea. You have to deal with the impact of waves, of weather, of other things that could get in the way. I mean, ships do sink once in a while. So it's not a friendly environment for running a chemical weapons destruction operation.
So, Ralph Trapp, if you were to consult the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on this, what would you suggest?
Well, I understand they are already in the process of assessing this as an option. I think that's exactly what should be done at this point in time. It is an option that needs to be assessed. We need to be aware of what can be done, what cannot be done, what would be the risks if one would go down that track. There's quite a bit of work to do before you can take a decision on this one, but I wouldn't rule it out as an option at this point in time.
Ralph Trapp is a chemical disarmament specialist. He's been speaking with us from France, where he lives. Thanks very much for your time, Ralph.
Thank you.
Let's stay on the Syria conflict and one player in it. BuzzFeed calls Mother Agnes Miriam an Assad apologist. State-backed Russian TV, on the other hand, condemns the liberal hawks who are trying to silence her. One thing's for sure, her name stirs up controversy. Mother Agnes Miriam is a Lebanese Catholic nun who used to live and work in Syria. Earlier this year, she was in the international spotlight for disputing the evidence that the U.S. and others said pointed to a chemical weapons attack by the Assad government. Russia cited her work as an argument against intervention in Syria. Mother Agnes claims that several children who appear as victims in a video of the alleged chemical attack last August were actually kidnapped after unrelated attacks elsewhere in Syria. And she says she's just trying to track them down.
The survivors, the families of those abducted people, they said that they discovered that some children abducted of their own were figuring as victims in the alleged chemical attack. So this pushed me to track the children in the videos, as I am an expert in observation because I restore icons and other heritage objects. I began to see some discrepancies, and finally, I was sure that something was going wrong. They asked me to put my observation on a paper, and that's how I compiled a 50-page study where I am mostly asking questions. But for me, and following those evidences, are staged, prefabricated, and fake, of course.
Credible sources, though, have disagreed with your claims. Human Rights Watch notably said that there's no basis for the claims advanced by Mother Agnes. They said they found no evidence to indicate any of the videos were fabricated. So how do you respond to that?
Well, until today, I read the allegation of Human Rights Watch. It's only, you know, discrediting me. I never said that I am a military expert. It's only from my position of a mere viewer.
Now, I know another one of your concerns, Mother Agnes, is that rebel groups are attacking religious minorities in Syria. Tell us about that. Have you seen that firsthand?
Well, to tell you the truth, I haven't so much underlined the minorities, the minority aspect of the problem. My main concern is human rights applied to all the Syrian population and whatever in the world. What I am deploring is really the barbarism that is now emerging in Syria, where a fundamentalist group under the cover of so-called religion are really bypassing all the red lines of any civilized world, and they are really perpetrating a barbaric act with the civilians. Of course, among those civilians, you have Christian minorities, like you have Alawite, and like you have Sunni also, that are becoming a minority, you know, the Sunni that are not aligned with a fundamentalist movement are also terribly slaughtered.
How does it feel to be a nun and putting yourself in a political role?
I don't think that it is a political role if you want, when you consider politics as having a party and being sided. It is not a political role. It is an ethical role. It is a social role. It is a humanitarian role. And it is a civilian role. Mm. And
But some have said, Mother Agnes, that you're now the most media-friendly face of the Assad regime. So how does that qualify you as nonpartisan?
If you consider that reconciliation is a friendly face, if you consider that humanitarian targets are friendly face, if you consider that forgiveness is friendly face, well, I will have to ask you, how am I a friendly face?
Mother Agnes Miriam, thank you very much for your time.
God bless you.
Mother Agnes Miriam is the Lebanese nun who stirred controversy after she disputed evidence of a chemical attack by the Syrian government. She's now calling for a negotiated solution to the Syrian conflict. If I say the word mayor, did you just think Rob Ford? As if you need any further proof that Toronto's leader is now the most famous or infamous mayor in the world. Yes, he admitted to smoking crack while in a drunken stupor, and the city council there has taken away many of his executive powers and part of his budget. And yes, he said things publicly you wouldn't want your kids to hear. But Ford vows to carry on. through it all, Ford supporters, and there are many, still have his back. Reporter Geneviève Auger went to meet some of them.
It's 10 a.m. at Woodbine Racetrack in northwest Toronto. It's too early for a horse race, but there are plenty of slot machines to keep people entertained. This is Etobicoke, the heart of Rob Ford country. People here voted for him as a city councillor three times before electing him mayor in 2010. Then they sent his brother Doug to fill his council seat. Anne, who prefers not to give her last name, says she doesn't care about the crack smoking and other bad behavior Ford's admitted to.
My opinion of him remains exactly the same. There is no change. He is who he is, and I voted for him, and I would vote for him again.
Anne's part of Ford Nation, the folks who support Rob Ford no matter what. She says the mayor has been doing a good job and that he's just been under a lot of pressure.
Everything is blown out of proportion. I'm sure that a lot of other politicians have a lot of skeletons in their closet, and if you're going to go there and dig everything out, it doesn't change anything.
Ford Nation is also the name of the mayor's television show on Sun TV, a small right-wing cable news channel.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Sun News and Ford Nation. I'm Mayor Rob Ford.
It got canceled this week after just the first episode. Sun TV says it can't afford it. But Rob Ford says he'll carry on fighting Toronto city elites on behalf of the little guy and trying to save taxpayers' money. That's the refrain that comes up again and again at the Woodbine Mall.
Because he's my boy. He does things for me. He's restricting the increasing taxes on the property. I vote for him as a councillor and as a mayor.
Italo Vinafro is a retired florist in his 70s, out shopping with his wife. Not the kind of person you'd expect to hear condoning the use of crack cocaine.
A lot of people do, yes. He had the guts to say that. He admitted it. I think it's one of the normal situations that people have done it, but because he's the mayor, he's getting blamed for it.
Like many Etobicoke residents, Vinafro has met Rob Ford. The mayor visited his street to try to resolve a neighbor's dispute. Ford is known for personally returning constituents' calls about everyday issues, like backed-up city sewers, a neighbor's fence that's too high, and problems with garbage pickup. What's notable about Ford Nation is just how diverse it is. The suburban, car-friendly boulevards of Etobicoke are home to many recent immigrants. People like Jernal Growal, who was born in India. He's another Ford backer.
I like him because he saved Toronto's tax. Number one, he's money saver. Rest is whatever he's drinking, he's doing in his own time, not in our time.
Now, Rob Ford did vote to increase property taxes by 1.6% over 3 years to pay for a subway extension, instead of opting for a less expensive light rail system. But a lot of his political support is about the personal. People like that he's a regular guy, and that unlike many other politicians, he's unpolished and completely unpredictable. For The World, I'm Geneviève Auger in Toronto.
You have your own stories, you know you do, and from time to time, you can share them on air in the form of a world quiz. Here's our latest.
Greetings, this is Annalisa in Sacramento, California. I listen to The World on Capital Public Radio, and I've come up with this week's quiz, and here we go. The place I am thinking of was discovered in 1904. It's the southernmost working post office in the world, settled by the British as a base during World War II, operated as a British research station until 1962. It was also designated Historic Site No. 61 under the Antarctic Treaty. So can you name this southernmost post office in the world? And the answer is Port Lockroy, Antarctica. I've actually had the chance to visit Antarctica. I was on a cruise with about 100 other tourists, and we were able to buy postcards. And I've been to now all seven continents, and that was my seventh continent. Okay, outside of Port Lockroy is a penguin colony, and they were very curious, especially the younger penguins that are molting. They'll come up and they'll peck you because they think you might be a larger penguin. Maybe you have some food. So they're just very friendly, and they're really cute, but they're really smelly. So thank you for listening to this week's quiz. And if you find yourself down in the southern part of the world. I hope you have a chance to enjoy Port Lockroy on the northeastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Well, you won't smell them, but you can see Annalisa Alvarado snapshots of penguins and icebergs at PRI.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. London, like many cities, is encouraging people to use bicycles more. The mayor there has even introduced special bike lanes, known locally as cycling superhighways. But in a city of 8 million, there are going to be more accidents, too, and sadly, some fatalities. Still, Londoners have been stunned by a rash of 6 cycling deaths in just 2 weeks, 3 of them on the same cycling superhighway. Mark Ames is a cyclist and author of the blog I Bike London. I asked him to describe these special bike lanes.
It's meant to be a way of getting a lot of people on a safe cycle route from A to B. And the cycle route is sort of denoted in the street with blue paint. But not all cycle superhighways are born equal. Some of them are fully separated from traffic, and some of them are, in fact, just blue paint and nothing more.
Right. And so where there is a barrier, have you been there and do you feel safe there?
Yeah, I use one of the routes quite a lot. It runs through my neighborhood. They're numbered. Each route is numbered. And Cycle Superhighway 2 is the one that is widely regarded to be the most problematic. It is just blue paint. I don't mind using it myself, but I'm fully aware that there are a lot of people, for example, perhaps older people or people who aren't able to keep up with the speed of the traffic, who would not feel comfortable riding there.
There is a video that London's Guardian News Online made of a cyclist with a camera mounted on his helmet riding this route where the 3 cyclists were killed. Let's listen to the clip of this ride.
Right, in a minute, we're going to be getting to Bow Roundabout, which is where there have been 3 deaths, including one earlier this week. Whoa! Hey, mate, you're a bit close. Take it easy, all right? You overtook me too close, all right?
I mean, Mark, you cycle this Bow Roundabout where these fatalities have occurred. What is the problem with this one spot?
Bow Roundabout is a really interesting place from sort of planning perspective. It's one of these places that was built back in the kind of 1950s, late 50s, early 60s, you know, when planning was all about the private automobile and the future was an exciting place and we'd be rushing forward towards mass motorization. So they built these huge junctions. At Bow Roundabout, you've got a pass under, a flyover, and a sort of multi-lane roundabout as well to accommodate an awful lot of traffic.
What do you think is a solution for cyclists to be safer on the roads of London?
Well, in London, you know, there's been a lot of debate recently about people wearing headphones as they walk down the street or as they cycle. But actually, the indications are that the recent fatalities that we've had are to do with specific junctions which are known to be dangerous and specific types of vehicles, HGVs, lorries, left turning across the path of cyclists. So,
what's HGVs?
An HGV is a heavy goods vehicle, so a really big articulated truck or a construction lorry. You know, if you were to ask someone what's killing people in London, that would be the answer. So the answer, of course, is, you know, what's going to make London safer is to restrict access for the very biggest vehicles. And that's a debate that's happening currently, where London is now considering copying schemes that exist in Paris and in Dublin and Stockholm, where they don't allow very big trucks into the city centre at peak times, you know, when children are riding to school, when people are walking and cycling to work.
Mark Ames is a cyclist and blogger in London. There's a link to his blog at PRI.org. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, we change tack a bit. Few things are as synonymous with Brazil as samba. The music and the dance are quintessentially Brazilian, and reporter Beto Arcos tried to soak as much of it up as he could recently.
When I was in Rio a few weeks ago, I sang and danced to samba in the clubs, I heard it on the radio, and I ate a feijoada, Brazil's national dish, while listening to a live samba group. But I wanted to get more insight into the world of samba. So I asked the young samba composer and singer, Leandro Fregonesi, to take me to some clubs and educate me. I wanted to know what is it about samba that drew him in. He started by telling me this.
It's very complete in terms of rhythm, melody, harmony. Here in Brazil, samba is the most representative way to express our emotions when we are happy, when we are not happy.
O tempo que passou valeu. Sem raiva e sem rancor.
And as I hopped from club to club listening to samba, I realized this music lets you express lots of different emotions. Fregonesi says that's partly because there are so many different kinds of sambas.
We have like samba de enredo, which is from the samba schools. We have samba de partido alto, which sometimes the singers, they improvise on the theme. We have
Here's a samba written by Fregonesi and Rafael dos Santos called Do Tambor ao Terço, or From the Drums to the Rosary. Now, pay close attention to the sound of the drums. Samba's roots are in Africa, and drumming is a key element. And so are the lyrics. Samba composers write about love and heartache, separation and reconciliation, tragedy and triumph. Sambas can be about food, soccer, even politics. This one, played by a band at the Carioca da Gema club in Rio, is about the arrival of democracy in the early 80s. It's called Vai Passar by the great Chico Buarque. Fregonesi says a good samba composer is a storyteller who's sharp and insightful.
This is very important in Brazil. The more witty the composer, more respected he is by others. It's a kind of measure.
Here's a witty samba called Samba Mestizo, co-written by Fregonesi and recorded by the godmother of samba, Betch Carvalho. It talks about the origins of the music and how samba became an anthem of freedom.
O samba é mestiço que nem o meu sangue brasileiro. Retrato de povo guerreiro que não cansa de lutar. É o compromisso de quem batalhou no terreiro. Canta o ano inteiro pra história não se acabar.
On the last night I was in Rio, my friend Nilson Ramon surprised me with a special gift. He got tickets to a samba song competition at one of the oldest institutions of Brazilian carnival, the Mangueira Escola de Samba, Mangueira Samba School, near Maracanã Stadium. There were hundreds of people dancing and singing like there was no tomorrow. I was in samba heaven. Never in my life I even imagined I'd get a chance to see this kind of spectacle. The biggest party I've ever attended. So the next time you hear a samba, you'll know why it's such a rich and vibrant music. It's a way of life. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
Não, ninguém faz samba só porque prefere.
And thank you, Beto, for that little lift into samba heaven. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.